summertime was nearly over. Blue Italian sky above. I said, lady, I'm a rover. Can you spare a fine word of love? She whispered softly, it's best not to linger.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Holden Graber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, now thankfully known as Live from the New York Public Library, as I have told some of you before. This used to be called PEP, Public Education Programs, but we changed it to Live because PEP sounded a little bit like something you might take if you have some stomach ailments. I'm here today to welcome you to the Day of Ideas Festival, a celebration of the Atlantic's 150th anniversary. We're celebrating the Atlantic at 150, and this evening, for those of you who have a lot of endurance, you should come back and hear a talk about Freud, that Slavoj Žižek, a mad Slovenian philosopher, will be giving. Mad, but I mean it with great affection. And we will also have a conversation between George Prochnik and Wayne Kirstenbaum. I love celebrating magazines. We've done it twice before, once for Slate, that has celebrated its 10th anniversary, the online magazine, and once for Spy magazine, though Spy magazine doesn't exist anymore. They were celebrating their 20th anniversary. Wonderful to celebrate an anniversary of someone who is dead. In any event, it is a great pleasure to be here, and a great pleasure to conclude with this day of celebration, the five city tour that the Atlantic has been having throughout America to celebrate their magazine. And if you think of it, in some ways, what we do here is very kindred to what they do on the pages of the magazine. What we're trying to do jointly here is to bring even more to life the life of the mind, the life of the page. The life of the page comes to life here in a conversation that you're going to witness in a few minutes. I'd like to particularly thank a few people from the Atlantic that matter greatly to me. First of all and foremost, Deborah Cunningham and Paul O'Neill, with whom I've been working for the last few months. I don't know how I got into doing 9 events in one day. I think it happened in Aspen, and I attribute it to the altitude. One dreams very strongly in altitude. And I would also like to thank the chairman of the Atlantic, David Bradley, as well as the president who's here with us today, John Galloway. Now, I encourage all of you who are here for this session to stay for the next, which I will be moderating or instigating, as I say, a session on lust with Esther Perel, who wrote a book called Mating in Captivity. I leave it to your imagination to imagine what that might be. Now, how will this session be run? It will last as long as a psychoanalytical session, so about 45 minutes. Then, unlike a psychoanalytical session, you will actually have time to ask a few questions. And I actually insist on the notion of question. In my experience, a decade of this, questions usually take about 54 seconds to articulate. So rather questions and statements. After that, at 60 minutes, we will ask all of those who are not staying for the next session to kindly move outside and perhaps purchase a book from one of the distinguished writers we have here, critics we have here today. Or if you'd like, we would like to invite anyone who is here today to stay on for the next session on lust. How could you refuse? I don't know. In any event, today, the trouble with diversity, we have arguing the case, Walter Ben Michaels, who is a professor of English at the University of Illinois at Chicago, widely noted as one of the founders of the New Historicism. He's the author of Our America and the Shape of the Signifier. Cassa Pollitt, who writes a Subject to Debate column, which appears weekly in The Nation. Pollitt has also written essays for such publications as The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, Harper's, and The New York Times. And Scott Stossel, the managing editor of The Atlantic, has been associated with the magazine since 1992. He joined the staff to help launch The Atlantic online, and in 1996 he joined The American Prospect, where he served as associate editor, and now he is back with The Atlantic. So quite a peregrination. Yeah, what I think and foresee for this evening, for this afternoon, I'm saying evening because I'm so used to doing them in the evening, what I foresee is a real argument. And I hope that there will be some irritation that will come from it. When you read Casa Pollitt's review of Walter Ben Michael's book, which you have a quotation on it, of it on your flyer, you will see why possibly this will be an argument. Now, I just would like to demonstrate very quickly how we are going to tell when 42 minutes is up. And then they will have 3 minutes after that. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you, Katha and Walter, and all of you for joining us tonight. We were talking just before we came on about we're following gluttony and preceding lust. So I hope you're not too full, but we're also hoping that this can sort of be like foreplay, and we can sort of build some anticipation for the next segment. They also asked me whether I wanted to sit between Katha and Walter or to the side of them, and as Paul says, hoping that there will be some conflict here, I decided it was best to sit not between them so I don't get caught in the crossfire. But I thought the way to start out here was by drawing the battle line, so to speak, as starkly as possible, and to have each of the two of you lay out your respective positions. So why don't we begin by having Walter just sort of in 5 minutes or less lay out the thesis of your book, The Trouble with Diversity, and then let's have Katha respond in a similar period of time with everything that's wrong with that thesis.
Okay. Thank you. Actually, I do want to just say thank both the New York Public Library and Scott and the Atlantic Monthly for doing this. You know, my day job is a professor of American literature, and the Atlantic Monthly matters for that because of William Dean Howells, who's an important figure. But then as I was thinking about this, I realized Howells was the Atlantic Monthly, right? But he was also sort of Harper's.
He went back and forth.
Yeah, then I think actually probably, then he edited N plus one, of course, and that made the sort of serious difference in his career. And I want to thank Katha, too. It's either, given the strength of her hostility to the book, it's either an act of extraordinary generosity that she's here, or else it's just exactly the opposite of an act of extraordinary generosity. And I don't know, it'd be hard to tell. I think I can say very quickly what the thesis is and probably what the sort of bones of contention are. I mean, the book begins by noting two, I think, important and more or less uncontroversial facts about American life in the last 30 years. One is that there has been a strong and in part successful, although I think we would mostly agree insufficiently successful, commitment to eradicating racism and celebrating diversity in our society. This doesn't mean that racism has by any means been eradicated, but it means that we are a very different society from what we were, let's say, 40 years ago before the beginnings of the Civil Rights Movement, or before the beginning of the modern Civil Rights Movement in that regard. There's also, at the same time, been a dramatic and increasingly noted increase in economic inequality in American life. And the question is, what is the relation between these two facts? And I think there's an important way in which they're disconnected and an important way in which they're connected. And one of the ways in which they're disconnected is this. The drive to eliminate discrimination, as admirable as it is, has, in my view, nothing whatsoever to do with the project of producing economic equality. And what I mean by that is quite simple. Prejudice, discrimination, sexism, racism, all play an important role in determining which people are going to benefit in our society and which people are not going to benefit, who is going to get rich and who is going to get poor. But it is not prejudice or discrimination that makes people rich and poor. It is capitalism, and particularly in the last 30 years in its neoliberal form, neoliberalism that makes people rich and poor. So the first part of the argument is that there's an important logical disconnect between these two commitments, and that insofar as we think that in pursuing an anti-discriminatory, an anti-sexist, an anti-racist agenda, we are also seeking to achieve economic inequality. Economic equality. That is a mistake. We are not doing that. And I give a sort of one example, just a very recent one. I was thinking this last weekend when I was thinking about this event, and I was struck by, presumably all of you, or many of you, felt what I certainly felt. One of the most gratifying parts of the last election was the defeat of George Allen, a completely loathsome person. I could never understand how he got elected, but they were talking about him being president. He lost. And we all know who we have to thank for that, in part. We have to thank the kid who wrote a column last week in the Post saying, "I am macaca." And then Frank Rich wrote a column in the Times calling 2006 the year of the macaca. There's a very quick version of this. If you know anything about this kid, Siddhartha is his name. He is a second generation Indian kid, comes from north the Virginia suburbs. He was raised, and I'm quoting Frank Rich here, by a well-off parents. His father's a mortgage broker. He went to a magnet public high school. He then went to the University of Virginia. He interned for a while for Joe Lieberman, and then he was working on this campaign. All of these things, he's an admirable kid. You know, if he were my son, I'd be proud. Everything he's done is admirable. Maybe the Lieberman thing, you have some questions about that. But everything else is completely okay. In his column, he says, and I hope he's right, that he hopes his little contribution, although it's a bigger contribution than most of us will ever make, certainly than I will, is to make America a more open society. And I hope that he has made America a more open society. And one of the ways that's been possible is, of course, because he himself, his very presence in this country, is a function of our commitments to anti-racism, a function of the civil rights movement. He could not have come here. His parents could not have come here under the 1924 Immigration Act, which was explicitly racist. But of course, they could come here under the 1965 Immigration Act, which is a product of the civil rights movement. So yeah, here's the first thing about him. He testifies to a certain kind of openness in American society. Here's the second thing about him. He is one of the kids whom I call in this book rich kids. That is to say, he is part of a process, just no fault of his own, which has been a commitment to diversity, but what's been diversified is, in effect, the elite. If you have a growing economic gap and you have a smaller but richer elite and a much larger group of everybody else, it is no doubt a slightly better world if that elite is a kind of more attractive elite, if it comes in many different races, and if it comes in different genders, and if it comes in different religions. It is not, however, any the less an elite because of that fact. So the central argument of this book is if you want to address the problem of the widening gap between the rich and poor, you are not addressing it when you try to make sure that both the rich on one hand and the poor on the other come in the appropriate races and genders. The goal should be not to try and diversify the elite and thereby, of course, also diversify everybody else. The goal should be instead to try to reduce, minimize, or perhaps eliminate altogether the difference between the elite and everybody else.
Well, I have an obvious, as you're speaking, I have an objection to that already formulating, but I'm going to leave it to Katha to articulate her own.
I want to thank the library and the Atlantic also for inviting me to do this. And I want to just say that if what Walter Ben Michaels has just said was what I had taken from his book, I would probably not have written such a disagreeing kind of column. But in fact, his book makes a much stronger case that I hope he's backed away from, that I'll get to in a minute. I want to just say that the areas where I agree with Michaels is that, of course, economic inequality is a central problem. It's huge. It's growing. I'm a socialist. You know, you're never going to get me to say, oh, no, economic inequality, who cares about that? Let's just make sure that within every social class, race and gender have the privileges of that social class. And I would say that economic inequality goes way beyond what you mostly discussed, which is income. It goes to basic wealth. It goes to our, you know, incredibly decrepit social services and the kinds of anxiety and panic and especially class anxiety that induces in people when they think, oh my God, you know, my health care, my old age, the public schools are terrible, et cetera, et cetera. All these things are incredibly important, and you would never get me to say that they don't matter. Another thing I'd like to say I agree with him about is that diversity, kind of a, I don't know, even the word bothers me, you know. It is often just a marketing device and a photo opportunity. You know, like if you look at the brochures for any college, you know that if they have two black students, they're both going to be on the cover. And you know that, you know, in a school that's trying to get more boys to apply there, they're going to have some manly boy, you know, holding a football. I would say that a lot of diverse, what we think of as diversity in our society, is very superficial. I don't agree that fighting race and gender discrimination is a completed project. I think it's interesting that the example that Michael's used of a person who proves that how much better things is not a black person. He's not a black person. He's an Indian. He's a prosperous immigrant. That's a very different kind of thing. And I think that because in the bien pensant liberal academic world, racism and sexism are very impolite, does not mean that in our society race and sex are not very, very important economic factors in the way our class society is structured. They are. I mean, you talk about affirmative action. We always talk about, you know, who gets to go to Harvard. Affirmative action is also about who gets a really good blue-collar job, who gets a government contract, who gets all the ability to participate in economic life. And I would say that if you go a little bit below the English departments of the Ivy League, you will find that there is a great deal of prejudice, including in our publishing world, you know, which is something that Walter Mosley and others, including me, you know, rediscover periodically. Oh my goodness, how come there are no black people working at all these liberal magazines? So I would say that race and gender discrimination are still live problems. I would also say another thing, which is that Michael's actually makes a stronger case in his book than you just made now, and I'd like to hear, you know, what you have to say about that now, which is, you don't just say, look, here on the one hand there's this little problem, race and sex discrimination, but over here is the big problem, and we should talk more about this big problem than this little problem. It's that the attention paid to race and gender discrimination masks economic inequality. It makes it hard to see that the fact that kids at Harvard, the rich kids, can look out and see, you know, what, 7% black faces, most of whom are not African Americans. They are prosperous members of the elites of black other countries. The fact that they can look out and see that makes them feel good that they're there, that they didn't take the place of someone who deserves to be there. And it masks the fact that most of the people who should be candidates for going to Harvard are too poor either to pay for it or to have the kinds of education and build up the kinds of cultural capital that would let them get in. Now, I just don't see any evidence that these two facts are related in that way. I don't see any evidence, and the book doesn't present any empirical evidence, although it puts this forward as an idea, that the administration of any college is going to say, I know how we can get people to forget that you have to pay $40,000 to go here and have a fabulous education, and probably it helps to go to private school. We'll have some black people. You know, we'll have some women. That's not the way it works. Those gains that blacks and women made through affirmative action and not through affirmative action were won in tremendous social struggle. And the idea that these are just things that the ruling class gives people, this is insane. If it weren't for this, the civil rights movement was not a project of the ruling class. And in fact, the civil rights project is in tough times today. You know, by many, many indicators, black people are not doing well. For example, if you look at who's in prison, that's worse than it was in 1960, because other things have happened too, like the whole war on crime and putting everybody in jail for drugs and all that kind of thing. So you've got enormous race-related problems, we know, for example, and then I'll stop, we know that every time they look and see, are black and white people treated equally when they go to get a job, when they try to get an apartment, when they go to get a mortgage, when they go to buy a car, when they're accused of a crime, we find out, hey, no, the black person gets a much worse deal in every way. Well, this is racism. That's what racism is. So, you know, I just don't know how you can say that, oh, this, we pay, you know, now we can stop paying so much attention to race. Whenever people stop paying attention to race, what the effect of that is going to be is more racism. And the same is true of let's not pay so much attention to women's rights. The effect of that is less women's rights. It's not more more equality across the board. It's less equality across the board.
Well, I'd like to get Walter to respond to that, but first, one thing that makes this dispute so interesting is that you are both self-avowed creatures of the left, let's say, and...
I never call myself a creature. Doesn't sound so nice.
But one would assume that you... One would expect that you espouse the same goals, and if not the same means, and maybe not. And again, this is why this is so interesting, that there's such stark disagreement here. So let me ask you to both... say, how would you characterize your politics and your ideology? And particularly with you, one of the critiques that you've gotten from in a lot of the reviews of the books is that you are a kind of a paleo-Marxist, that you see everything purely in terms of class. Now, you're a socialist, and so that would one would think that you have some sympathy to this point of view. But where's the difference in terms
of... No, she's the one who accused me of being a paleo-Marxist. Look, first of all, I'm really struck by the fact, in rooms like this, I am often... paleo-Marxist would be the good news, sort of fascist, racist fascist, the bad news. However, on talk shows, I am a raging communist. That is, I find that on talk shows, I do nothing but get phone calls from people who want to describe how, despite the fact that I claim that class mobility is reduced in the US, they themselves are risen from the ranks. Although the best one I ever got was a couple of weeks ago, when a guy was proving to me there was class mobility. And the way he was proving it was by saying, hey, look, he started out at Yale, he kind of flunked out, he's been sinking like a stone ever since, and now he's at the bottom of the American class system. And who am I to say that people don't go up and down, you know? But I do think there is an important point here. I think there is a real difference. And the difference can be in this way. Look, no one, including me and including in this book, denies either that there is continuing racism or that, in fact, we can see the consequences of racism in, for example, fundamental facts like the overrepresentation of African Americans in the bottom quintiles of American wealth and underrepresentation in the top. And in fact, one of the arguments about the book is that the only racism that's ever really mattered in the US, and you know this perfectly well because you've read the book, is anti-black racism. I sort of take the Malcolm X position on that. Perhaps we can talk about that later. But it's a complete mistake, in my view, a mistake that I think Catherine makes, but I think many others have made as well, to go from that imbrication of the fact that black people are the victims of racism and that their poverty is in part, and indeed largely, let's say, a consequence of racism, to thinking that the battle against racism is going to make a fundamental difference for us. Indeed, I think racializing poverty is a crucial problem. And the person who made this point best for me was actually Tavis Smiley, whose radio show I was on last week, who pointed out to me that he had heard a version of this argument before in Martin Luther King's last book, in the last chapter of that last book. And what King says, I went back and looked at it, I guess I read it at the time, but I sort of forgot, I would have put in a footnote, I assure you, because it's good to have the Dr. Martin Luther King on your side in these debates. But what King said was, look, poverty, the largest number of poor people in the US are white people. Their poverty is real, it is not the function of discrimination. And the important point about there was not what, well, let's start feeling sorry for the poor white people too. I got no more sympathy for the poor or less for the poor white or anybody else. It's rather that it's a mistake to think of poverty as such as a function of discrimination. And that if we did manage to achieve the utopia that no doubt we all desire with respect to discrimination, that is, end it altogether, and present racism, and the consequences of past racism, we would still have a society which was just as unequal as it is now. So the point here is not to give up on anti-racism. The point, and this is a point that I think Katha probably deeply disagrees with and many others have a problem with, is that if you are a neoliberal, That is, if you are someone who's committed to globalization, who's committed to making capitalism function as unrestrainedly and as efficiently as possible, you should also be on the side of the anti-discrimination left. Indeed, at one point I called the anti-discrimination left the sort of human resources version of the neoliberal right. Why? Because you don't want a world in which people are prevented from rising to the top and making you vast money for your corporation just because they're gay or they're black or they're Indian or whatever. You want a world where the people who can make the money for you are making the money for you. There's a sense then in which, while it's completely important to pursue an anti-racist agenda, the anti-racist agenda is in no sense whatsoever an anti-capitalist agenda. And I think one of the problems with American liberalism is that we have signed on much more strongly, you know, to the anti-racist agenda than we have to the anti-capitalist agenda. And the goal would be to have a political campaign which was not celebrating what Rich called the year of the macaca. In American political life, every year is the year of the macaca. Every year is a year in which some form of prejudice will emerge one way or the other. In the old days, the year of the macaca was the racist always won. In the new days, thank God, they don't win so often or as much. But what we want is a moment when you don't get to be a conservative just by saying, well, I think affirmative actions reverse discrimination against white people, and you don't get to be on the left by saying, no, no, I'm for affirmative action and George Allen is so a racist. What you get to be a conservative is by defending the justice of economic inequality, of saying, yeah, it's true it's unequal, it's true it's getting more unequal, but it's a good thing. And what you get to be on the left is to be a leftist by saying, no, the fundamental issue here is economic inequality, and it's not a good thing, and that's what we should be arguing about. So from my perspective, the problem is that liberalism is increasingly less committed to arguing about that, which doesn't mean that people on the left aren't for economic equality, but it does mean that liberalism has been more or less hijacked by an issue that has not that much to do with economic inequality, but in principle, nothing whatsoever to do with economic inequality.
Well, I want Kathy to respond, but the obvious objection to that, and it's...
There's an obvious objection, oh my God.
Which has been presented in numerous reviews, why is it a zero-sum game? That to the extent that we all agree that, or many on the left would agree that economic equality may be the preeminent, rectifying that as the preeminent goal, and yet there is a sense in which racism and sexism are bound up with this.
Let me just answer this one, and then you will talk for a long time. Look, it's not a zero-sum game in a logical sense. These things are not contradictory, right? But the point of the opening remarks, which I'm not making this up, right, is that during the period when we've been doing the work on racism, insufficient, but during the period we've been doing that, we've gotten more and more unequal. It's not like we're spending a certain amount of time doing this, a certain amount of time doing that, and it's just we haven't got enough time to make it all come out right. It's that liberalism in general, and I don't mean everybody on the left in this country, lots of people on the left who are working in this, but we know perfectly well they aren't running for office unless they're working for the Labor Party in South Carolina. Liberalism in general has had a lot of success with part of this agenda, that is, let's call it, in general, the civil rights agenda. Well, although I agree with Kathy, it's not an unqualified success, and in some respects it's being pushed back, and the black prison population is a very real issue. It's had a lot of success with that, and it's increasingly ignored the other. Now, you're saying, is it a zero-sum game? Are we required to ignore the other? No, we're not required to ignore the other. But the fact that we're not required to doesn't mean that we haven't, in fact, been doing that, and the evidence for that is the last 40 years. We can do Gini coefficient numbers later if people like to play with numbers, but it's not good news for economic equality.
I think the Gini coefficient numbers would kill any appetite for the lust thing afterwards. So, but
it's like counting backwards from
that. You know, it's interesting that if you're right and capital could just be saying, right, I would love to have all these very bright black and women working for me and making me a ton of money, therefore, getting rid of racism and sexism is in my interest. It is so interesting that they have not done that. It is so interesting that black people and women are discriminated against at every job level. There, you know, you make fun of women on Wall Street who, you know, decided not to put up with being treated in incredibly demeaning and sexist ways, and won their lawsuit, won the Morgan Stanley lawsuit. But in fact, sure, if you can exploit somebody extra because you can get away with it, why not do it? And because it makes the people, the whites or the men or whoever happy, great. Go do it. This is true everywhere. So I would say, I mean, I would never say, and I don't think anybody would ever say, that yes, if only blacks and women were not discriminated against, capitalism would be an egalitarian system. Capitalism can't be an egalitarian system because it's based on exploitation. I mean, that's so simple. I want to go back, though, and say, you know, I didn't call you a paleo-Marxist. I grew up with paleo-Marxists. That was my family. And this sure. is something else. What I said is you were a primitive Marxist.
Okay, sorry.
And what I meant by that, but what I meant by that.
I just couldn't deal with that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, right. No, but then I said you weren't primitive enough because, and I want to get to that. What I meant by primitive Marxist is someone who thinks that there really is only one principle operating in society, that everything like the mill in the sea that grinds out the salt, everything can be derived from one principle. And I think that's a very simple way of looking at even an economic system. And I don't know any economics, but just take it from me, it's true. What I meant by not primitive enough is that I want to draw your attention to the slippage in your, the way you talk between these categories, the left, liberals, the Democratic Party, and us. These things are all used interchangeably. They are very different. I would say that the left in America is about this big. The liberals are different. Liberals are not people who are dedicated to the eradication of economic inequality in our society. They are people who believe in the rule of law, the Constitution, a society that isn't quite as horrible as the one we live in now in various ways, civil liberties. They're not socialists. They're not anti-capitalist. Liberalism is a kind of pro-capitalist person. The ACLU are liberals. They're not socialists. You can be very, very conservative and be liberal, conservative economically, and be liberal in the sense that most people use it now. Who us is, I don't know. I would say that there are a lot of people in us who actually aren't so interested in being feminists or being anti-racist. And I would say that in the... from what I've seen in the places where I've worked, you can be extremely, extremely committed to, you know, politics way over off on the left here, and racism and sexism still are like the add-ons. They're still like, you get everything all set up and then you look for a woman. You get everything all set up and you look for a black person. That never works. That never, never works. I have had an entire lifetime of being the only woman on the panel. And I'll tell you just one funny story about that is at a certain point, I decided I would only be on panels if there was another woman. And I tried that on with Monthly Review, a socialist and Marxist magazine. They said, well, we'll get back to you. And that was the last I heard from them. And that was about 5 years ago. So I think that, I mean, that's just a, you know, that's just a joke. That's not the idea. Like, that's where inequality is. So I would say that, you know, you have to really kind of disaggregate all these things. And then you have to look at... of course it would be a better world if within each social class there was no race and gender discrimination. Of course, that would have enormous consequences for the people in those social classes. It would mean that women, that there would be child care. It would mean that marriage would be more equal because people would make more would be more economically equal within it. It would mean that workplaces would be structured in an entirely different way. And that little extra bit of humiliation that goes along with knowing that you are discriminated against would not be there. You know, and that's not just an economic thing. So I would say that you can fight on several fronts at once. I feel. That's what we are called upon to do. I don't think we're called upon to say, as the old left always did, you know, oh, women, we'll get to that later, you know, or black people, well, okay, but the real thing is, you know, organizing the factory and being for the union that doesn't have any black people in it, et cetera. So I think that you have to sort of look at who you're addressing in a slightly different way. I think these things look a little different outside academia, where the us is just...
The us here is not the academic us. I mean, it absolutely is true. Look, there's a very small socialist party in the US. There's a party actually I belong to, the Labor Party in the US. Probably a lot of you know the work of Adolf Reed, who's a sort of close colleague of mine in this regard. The point here is to produce a kind of national political debate. I don't imagine the trouble with diversity is going to do that, although I know a whole metropolitan would be very happy if it did. But when I use sort of Democrats and liberals and left interchangeably, and Kath is right to say the book sort of does do that, it's not because I'm not aware of the conceptual distinctions one can make between liberalism and socialism, which are, after all, the heart of like any kind of political theory. It's because there were moments in American society when what it meant to be a liberal Democrat was to be above all for the end of or the minimization of economic inequality. Huey Long was one of those moments. He pushed Franklin Delano Roosevelt to the left with some success. Those moments have not been at the center of our politics for a long time. And I think it's naive to say that we can fight on many different fronts, not because it's not true. Of course, we can fight on many different fronts, but one way of thinking about fighting on many different fronts is you're fighting the same enemy, but on lots of different fronts. But in this case, the many different fronts that we're supposed to be fighting on are actually fighting different enemies, and that's part of the point of the book.
But you actually say that sometimes, you argue more strongly than that, and actually say that fighting on some of these fronts undermines the fight on other fronts.
I say it distracts from,
some of these more provocative.
The things
provocative.
I actually said.
At several points in the book, you say that commitment to diversity is a reactionary position. You would say at one point that race-based affirmative action is a kind of collective bribe that rich people pay themselves for ignoring economic inequality. And at one point, you say that the left on these issues of diversity is the police force for the right on race.
Well, I would say I actually don't want to back off from any of those. On the contrary, you know, I'm sure not unique in this regard, but when I do presentations about this book, people regularly read large swatches aloud and they'll look at the audience like, ha. But I'm just thinking, gee, yeah, I think that's right. And I still think that's right. Part of the point of it here is that that's not, though, about anti-racism. That's about diversity. I completely stand behind that. My son, to whom I passed on as much inequality as I could buy, just like we all do, is about to go to work for a law firm. There's a thing called the American Lawyer. The American Lawyer rates law firms. They have something called the A-list. There are three fundamental criteria that get you on the A-list. One is what they call culture. Culture means how hard do these kids have to work for their $145,000 a year in their first year job. It's got a good culture, they don't have to work that hard. A bad culture, they have to work really, really hard. The second thing is profits per lawyer. It's obvious why that's on the list. That's what the law firm is the business to do. The third thing is diversity. These people totally get there is zero contradiction between the commitment to profits per lawyer and the commitment to diversity. And in fact, it is the human relation. Every one of these law firms has a human relations division. It is the diversity division. And what it does is make sure that all the budding young lawyers making their $145,000 a year come in the appropriate colors and that they feel comfortable when they get there and that they sort of celebrate the experience they're having. And so I do think it is absolutely true to say that what we mean by diversity today is largely a way of organizing a workforce so that it becomes a more efficient and therefore more profit-producing workforce. So yeah, that's provocative, but it's true.
Katha?
The reason there are those commitments to diversity is because they're civil rights law. It's not because capitalism or the law firm got this idea out of their head, let's exploit some more people and make some more money. If they didn't do that, women, blacks, whoever was discriminated against, would bring lawsuits. That's what it's all about. If they took those laws away, we'd go back to where we were very, very quickly. Because it is a stretch. It is a stretch for many white people to work with black people. It is a stretch for men to have to work with women as equals. They just as soon not do it. In fact, there are whole economics careers that are based on the rationale, why racial and gender discrimination is economically rational. So the idea that it's economically rational the other way is not so obvious to me. Anyway, I just want to say another thing, which is something that you do that I really envy as a writer, and I wish I could do this more. I'm going to start doing this more, is to make myself look like the only person who says something when actually a lot of other people are saying it. For example, The Nation magazine, the magazine I work for, constantly puts forward what they call economic populism, which is exactly what you're talking about. And they are the people that I have this fight with about, you know, race and sex. You know, I have this with Eric Alterman all the time. In These Times is another magazine that obsesses about the labor movement in exactly the way you're talking about. The American Prospect, where the first chapter of your book was published. Even the campaign of John Edwards. I mean, the man did run for vice president. This is, you know, it's not some secret.
Yeah, I quote him.
You know. Okay, I know.
Which is the one thing you agree on. I think you like John Edwards, you like John Edwards.
Yeah, he's all right. But,
he's not exactly a socialist.
No, he's not exactly a socialist. Tom Frank, who you mentioned very briefly, but Tom Frank is a rock star. There cannot be a Democratic Party conference without Tom Frank being there to tell everybody how important economic inequality is. And if I could just refer to our last election day, the popular wisdom about that is that it was a big referendum about economic inequality having gone too far. And all these supposedly conservative Democrats like Webb, who Mukaka helped elect, even if they're conservative in certain ways, I mean, the guy was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of the Navy. He was a Republican until quite recently. But, you know, he is an economic populist. He says, I look around, I see too much poverty, I see things going the wrong way. I want to step in and change it. And he won in Virginia. So anyway, the point is, it's not like nobody thinks about economic inequality. It's just maybe, I do think that maybe they don't think about it enough in English departments, but they do think about it a lot in sociology departments. They think a lot about it in journalism school. I mean, if you want to be an investigative reporter, this is definitely something that you would study. In the whole education, if you want to get a, you know, go into theory of education, our rotten, horrible, incredibly stratified public schools would be a major subject of interest. Other social sciences, the places where you'd find the same thing but flipped, like it's good, would be economics and political theory, which tend to be fairly right-wing. But anyway, so I just don't see that nobody thinks about this. I think people think about economic inequality all the time. And the reason there's so much of it, just to finish up, is not because we've all been distracted thinking about other things, because these things are not about what we're thinking. These are about very deep trends in the economy. The reason there's more economic inequality now is because the decline of unions, and I think Adolf Reed would agree with me about that. It doesn't matter what the intelligentsia thinks about, you know, how to put together race, class, and gender, because this is a tiny number of people. What matters is how people are or are not organized and positioned to make themselves economically more powerful. And we're at a point where people are not very well situated to do that because of structural features in our economy.
Well, at one point you say, and I think you're kidding, in your
book. And the Republican Party.
In your book, that the best hope for egalitarianism really is that poor college students should start stealing iPods from rich college students. And I think you're merely kidding, but it's getting at a larger point, which is what are the goals of a progressive politics? And again, you don't really make the leap from saying, you know, it's if this notion that focus on diversity and race-based politics and race-based affirmative action sort of distracts from or masks the real underlying class issues. That raises another question I'd like to ask you, which is why are Americans afraid of class? But you know, what are the policy implications? I mean, does a progressive politics really come down to just redistribution of wealth?
Well, yeah, I would say that would be the basic thing, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and actually even the tone of voice in which you asked that question is good. It sort of goes against a bit of what was just being said. I just don't think, I mean, first of all, when you write on everything, people tend to say two things more or less the same breath. One is, that's ridiculous, and the other is, that's obvious, and everybody, so no one believes that, everybody believes that. And there's no doubt some truth in that, and I should have for sure have given more credit to the nation. But the thing, a way of framing it would be to this, to go back to something you said before about the woman on Wall Street, the Morgan Stanley case. The Morgan Stanley case is a woman who sued for sexual discrimination and won. And the sexual discrimination took this form. when they were bringing clients, they would deal with the clients during the day, and then the guys would, and I'm quoting from the trial transcript here, dump her in the cab while they took the client off to a strip club. Okay? And she sued and she won. There's another class action suit, a much larger one, currently in place right now, and that is the Walmart class action suit. And that's, again, where women are suing because they are, just as the Morgan Stanley person was, systematically underpaid at Walmart. At Walmart, women make $20,500 a year. Men make, it looks like, $21,600 a year. And it obviously is true that the women should make just as much as the men. Nothing I'm saying goes against them. But one of the points I'm trying to make is that if you see the Walmart problem as a sexual discrimination problem, you've made a serious mistake, because the real point is no one can live on that salary. If you then take it back to the Morgan Stanley example, the person who won the case, Allison Shifflin, was making a lot less money than the men. The men made $1.6 million a year. Allison Shifflin made only $1.2 million a year. After that case was adjudicated, she got a substantial settlement, and no doubt if she went back to work at Morgan Stanley or whoever took her place, will make $1.6 million. I believe the women should be paid as much as the men, but the obvious point is that this is a way in which we frame a debate. We frame both these debates about this woman on Wall Street, the women of Morgan Stanley, and the women of Walmart, as if the issue here were sexual discrimination, when the issue is obviously not sexual discrimination. It doesn't mean that there is no sexual discrimination. It means that the fundamental issue here is these guys are making $1.6 million a year, and these guys are making $21,500 a year, and that's where the injustice is. Now, it's absolutely right, where we do all agree, is that the impoverished union movement has a lot to do with this. The question is, though, why is it impoverished? And it's not like unions just disappeared, and it's not like there are, although the right wants us to believe there are, sort of these laws of economics, i.e. the neoliberal laws of economics, which are driving unions out of existence. It's that, in fact, the American left has, or American liberalism, or us, or whomever you want to call it, has, in fact, been much more successful both in the world and in relation to itself at promoting a series of issues which don't have a lot to do with that problem. And when you start listing what counts as liberalism, that problem, economic inequality, appears as one of several. But this is the primitive Marxist part. It's not one of several. It's foundational. Because just think for 2 seconds. If you solve that problem, you know, just imagine it solved, a lot of the other problems would begin to look much less severe very quickly.
That's probably true, but I'd like to hear Katha's response to that, and particularly to the Morgan Stanley case, and let me add another element into the stew here, because you also say in the book that you talk about domestic abuse and say that it's actually much more attributable to money. It's a money issue rather than one of relation between the sexes or,
I take back the domestic abuse.
Well, go ahead.
Okay, just very quickly, I think you mischaracterized both those cases. Allison Shifflin was, fighting for herself and 300 other women. It was not just about who gets to go to a strip club, although I actually feel that that is kind of disgusting. And
I don't think it's bad.
But if you read a book like In the Boom Boom Room by I forget who, she really does make a very strong case about, you know, it's really pretty disgusting and piggish on Wall Street, and women really are quite discriminated against. The Walmart case is not just about pay. It's also about promotion. And it's also about sexual harassment. So these are actually a little more complicated. If you have a workplace where, say, you know, it's one reason the women were making so much less is that they didn't get to get any promotions, it looks a little, it's not really like the difference of $1,000. Let's just not get all upset about that and fight for communism. I want to say, you know, the idea that the left paying attention, I just want to say this again, paying attention to race and sex is the reason why unions are in trouble, is just really not factual. The reason unions are in trouble are besides the fact that the union manufacturing jobs are now not being performed in America, is because there has been 20 years of Republican rule that has gutted labor law. The book to read about this is Which Side Are You On? By Tom Gehagan, who is a labor lawyer, who lays it all out just brilliantly, that you cannot win a union struggle now the way you could win before. And you know, unions aren't popular among working people for a lot of reasons in certain places. Now they're getting more popular because people realize what it's like not to have them. But at crucial moments, people weren't so interested. So anyway, this is not the fault of, you know, intellectual leftists.
Yeah, but you know whose fault it is? That's the fault of the Reagan Revolution. And the Reagan Revolution is not unrelated to all these ideas. In other words, one of the things that made Reagan powerful as a politician was precisely his ability to sort of manipulate the whole race sex card so that it made it, he created, in a strong sense, the idea of the liberal elite. And that liberal elite is like the stereotype that we're all living up to.
30-second response.
Ronald Reagan ran as a racist. Ronald Reagan began his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where those three civil rights people were murdered, and he said that he was for ethnic purity. It was a completely coded racial appeal, and he won on that. He did not win by saying, you know, I'm for women, I'm for black people.
Let's open it up to some questions. I'm sure we've provoked. I hope we've provoked lots of. Yes.
It's remarkable that despite all of the horrendous revelations about that loathsome racist swine George Allen, that he only lost the election by 7,000 votes. Makes you think a lot of people actually rallied to his side the more they heard about his life history. Since both of you are very concerned, obviously, with the unequal distribution of wealth and income in the society, it surprises me that neither of you dealt with the issue of legacy, and in particular with, apologies to you, Kathy, about sexism, but specifically on racism. Neither of you mentioned the overlooked issue of slave reparations, which is something that's widely dismissed in society. And yet, you know, clearly there are descendants of slave families, many generations removed, albeit, but who are still have never been able to climb out of that poverty. And on the other side, many beneficiaries of a slave past that still flourish today, including New York State, who built the Erie Canal with slave labor, Brown University, the Rockefeller family, the DuPonts, and you could go on and on, Union Pacific Railroad, on and on and on. So I'd like to hear your comments regarding reparations, and also, which is a distinctly capitalist notion, by the way, but also, would you disagree that that even if you had no discrimination whatsoever today, no racist discrimination, today, that without reparations to address these legacy issues, that you would still have very, very wide disparity of wealth in the society across racial lines, even without any discrimination whatsoever today.
Why don't you go first? Walter has a whole chapter on that.
Yeah, there is a whole chapter on the book, and this is, I think, where I should say, go buy the book. It's on Amazon. It's discounted, like they're basically giving it away. But the short answer is going to be something like this. I actually come out in favor of reparations in the book, not because although I think the principle of reparations is completely mistaken, and there's a lot about that in the book. I come out in favor of it because even though it's true that, you know, to the extent that we have you know, wealthy African Americans in the country, they would benefit from it too. Obviously, for the reasons we all know, African Americans would a disproportionately large number of poor people would benefit from reparations. But the problem with reparations is the problem that you precisely described. And here's an easy way to put it, just a little thought experiment. We have two kids. One of them is the kid of a descendant, grandchild of slaves, and descendant and child of someone who suffered under Jim Crow, and she is suffering from structural inequality. And here's another kid. The grandfather was the owner of slaves. And then the father just pissed away that great fortune the guy had made owning slaves. And this child's born just as poor as the other one. One of them is owed reparations. One of them, she was exploited, her ancestors. The other one, his ancestors were the exploiters. But surely the principle of justice here has nothing whatsoever to do with the history of lost property. In a society committed to equality of opportunity, both these kids, the grandchild of Simon Legree and the grandchild of Uncle Tom, both these kids are owed an equal opportunity. So I support reparations for practical reasons, although it's odd because it's never going to happen practically. But in fact, I think the principle is completely mistaken.
Well, I support reparations. I think, you know, one problem with the way people usually think of it is they think an individual black, you know, African American descendant of slaves would get this sum of money that would somehow equal, you know, their suffering. And then that allows everybody to get all upset about that and say, well, I wasn't even here when there was slavery, and so why should I have to pay this particular person? We're all here now. Who cares about the past? But I think that, you know, every institution that serves black people is totally inferior. That's important. Their schools are worse than the schools that even working class whites go to. Their hospitals are worse. Everything is worse. I said this before. They are still discriminated against. It's just a myth that this isn't happening now. Let's follow a black child and a white child equal, absolutely equal in terms of their income level, to get into a gifted and talented program in the New York City public schools. And Acorn actually brought a lawsuit, because when the black family shows up, they say, oh, we're all full. It's just like trying to rent an apartment. When the white family shows up, they say, oh, your little child, of course. So, you know, of course, at a certain point, you have to talk about these things in terms of sociology, in terms of large social groupings. It can't all be just individual this and individual that. So I support it, but it does seem to me a big political stretch. It just seems to me that we'd be living in a different America if reparations could be passed.
Right there.
I just want to go back to a basic question, and that is, I do believe in redistribution of wealth, but I also think if we do not think of the other properties that divide poor people and rich people, that is the property of whiteness, property of maleness, property of many other, those kind of properties, if we don't address them, then how can we go towards a proper redistribution of the economic property? That's my question.
The only thing I would say is just turn it around. I mean, is that we all agree that there are those differences, although the racial differences are, we actually scientifically don't so much agree about that. People, scientific consensus, insofar as there is one now, is that there is no such thing as a biology of race. And I do talk about that sort of in the book, although we've hung on to race because I argue we like races for reasons we've sort of discussed. But I just would say, if you want to flip that, it's not as if getting at the racial differences and the gender differences and the sexual differences has proven to be an effective way of addressing economic inequality. We've been trying to get at those a lot, and we have made a certain amount of progress doing it. And while we're doing it, the economic inequality has been getting worse. So it's not the case that we can sort of like start from that side and move to that side. And what I'm arguing is, no, let's start from this side. Let's start from the economic equality issue. I mean, imagine a world in which you had guaranteed minimum income, which is something that Martin Luther King was for and that Richard M. Nixon was for, hard as it is to believe. Imagine a world in which you did have universal health care. Imagine a world in which schools, public schools, weren't based on property taxes. Imagine a world in which all those things were put into place. And then once those things were put into place, first of all, poor people, since and especially black people, since they are disproportionately poor, would benefit from all those things. And then we can say, absolutely, we want to eliminate other forms of discrimination. We want to eliminate all the things we've been talking about. No one is defending those. But, you know, we love putting those identity issues first. And that's actually the single thing this book is most polemicizing against, putting the identity issues first.
Catherine, do you have any?
Well, just to pick up on the last thing you talked about equal distribution of school funding. I mean, you know, here in New York City, we've had a huge lawsuit that's been going on for, I don't know, over a decade with the state about exactly this, getting our fair share of money from the state for our public schools. And you can see how hard that struggle is. And I can promise you that the reason that it's so hard is not just because, you know, there are ruling class people who don't want this. It's all those upstate people. It's much more complicated than that. It would be wonderful, but I'll tell you something else. We would have to go much further than that. Even if the schools each got an equal amount of money, they would still be unequal schools, because poor kids and kids who don't speak English have much, much greater needs.
Well, so you in would other agree words, on that.
Yeah, yeah. So we would, I mean, you know, we would have to have an enormous social movement, but it would have to have it would have to pay conscious attention to race and gender, or there would be none.
Because there's a lot of disagreement here, but here's one moment of real agreement and a little bit of disagreement. We both agree that you have to go way deeper than the list I gave, and way deeper even than the list that Katha gave. We both agree you have to have a massive social movement. What I'm saying is, look, we've been talking about a certain set of issues for a long time now. We have not been generating a massive social movement. We've been generating this kind of like parody of a massive social movement. It may be the case that the right is right and nothing can change the laws of economics. But part of what I'm saying, if one's going to have, a practical program, is maybe we should try class as the way of generating a massive social movement. And one reason to try it is because there's way more poor people than there are rich people. They don't happen to be in this room, although at least don't look that poor in any event, but they are more of them. And instead of preaching to them about their racism, preaching them about their sexism, all of which are bad things, and they should learn to be better just like we have learned to be better or are trying to learn to be better, we should start actually producing a movement which, if it was going to be a mass movement, had to have some relation to the actual masses.
The gentleman up there has been waiting.
I just want to make a comment for the young man. Just inequality, economic inequality that we have here. It's only matched by the one we had during the Great Depression. At that time, we had these problems, but nobody blamed diversity for that causes. That's my comment.
They blamed capitalism.
Yeah, but can I say one tiny little thing? You know, an interesting thing about those programs to combat the Depression is that they were organized in a very racist way. They were. For example, things were excluded that black people did, like domestic work and farm work done by people of color. There were programs that were limited to white people. After World War II, for example, they built a lot of housing. A lot of that housing was limited to white people. All I'm saying is that a lot of things that look like we can all be in them together, actually, if you look at them closely, they are organized in a way that excludes
on
the basis
of race. Surely the point is not to go back and do it wrong again. The whole point is that, they did it wrong. Any scholar of the American Depression knows perfectly well that Roosevelt could only sell his programs, especially in the South, if he completely racialized them. They're pure Jim Crow programs. But the whole point is not to say, they used to be pure Jim Crow programs, so we can't do it. The whole point is to say, let's not do the Jim Crow version, but let's still do the mass movement version.
I'm afraid we only have time for one more question. There was someone over here.
Here we go. I have a question. It seems to me that one of the greatest arguments on behalf of Professor Michael's own argument is the sort of structure of the debate and the conversation, which sounds like a lot of people saying yes, but to the thesis of the book, which is. In other words, yes, well, maybe this is important, but you can't forget about racism. But, you know, let's not forget about these other things. And these other things are also contributors to general inequality. And I'm not hearing Professor Michaels saying that they're not contributors, but what I am hearing is that that the appeal to diversity has become an adequate synecdoche for progressive politics that has come, you know, in many ways increasingly to ignore the sort of central basis of class in that, and that the book's argument is to really return to focus on that, not to the exclusion of other things, but in point of fact, in recognition that these other preoccupations have themselves. Come to divert attention from something that's even more essential. And I'm just wondering if that's something that you all, if I'm taking away something that you all would feel is accurate in terms of your own approach to that.
My response is amen. Yeah, completely. That's exactly right.
Kathy?
Well, I think you're getting the sort of Michael's light. I think that actually, if you read the book, it actually does say, pay less attention. That the attention we pay to race and class, to race and sex, is bad because it prevents attention to class, and that it's a kind of ruling class plot to get people to pay less attention to class. And I don't accept that. I think there is no evidence for it. At least there's no evidence in the book.
Well, thank you all very much for coming, and thank you to Katha and Walter. If they haven't sold out yet, the New York Public Library is selling right outside here, outside the auditorium, at a very deep discount. Both Katha's book, Virginity or Death, which is a collection of her columns over the last few years, and the book we've been discussing this afternoon, which is The Trouble with Diversity. So thank you, and thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.